Hello, hello, and welcome to the Teacher Think Aloud podcast, a podcast for reflective practice for teachers of English around the world. I'm your co-host, Shay.
And I'm Anna.
And today, we're placing aside our teaching hats and putting on our advocate caps.
Yes, we know that teachers play a lot of roles and that we're always advocating for the best for our students. But not every teacher is quick to identify explicitly as an advocate.
Right. I think we often overlook the advocacy work that we're doing within our classrooms as simply part of the job, right?
Mm-hmm. Right. But, I mean, delivering individualized learning, recognizing and catering to each student's unique needs and learning styles.
Advocacy.
Yeah. Creating a classroom that values diversity, promotes acceptance, and ensures that every student feels welcomed and respected.
Advocacy.
Facilitating effective communication between parents and students and other key stakeholders.
Also advocacy. You don't have to be storming Capitol Hill to consider yourself an advocate, teachers.
Right. And here to help us address this misconception today is our advocacy guide, Rosemary. Let's meet her.
Okay. Well, first, thank you for having me. This is really cool. I love talking about what we're going to be talking about. My name is Rosemary Colon. Pronouns are she and her. And I am a wearer of many hats. I think the best things to describe me are teacher and learner. In addition to that, I am also the current president-elect for WASOL, so the affiliate for Washington State for TESOL. Yeah, so that's me. And yeah, I'm currently teaching at the higher ed level.
I met Rosemary when I moved to Seattle and joined the WASOL community a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. And I got to meet Rosemary at TESOL 2023 in Portland when she joined us for a chat and sip and shared some of her reflections on the conference. I remember she said advocacy was her jam. And we just knew in that moment that she would be the perfect guide on this conversation.
Absolutely. But before we let her take the reins, we had to throw her an icebreaker question.
Mm-hmm. And listeners, please note that we've had this episode in the works for a while, so you might have some new thoughts on our question based on what you saw at the Academy Awards and Golden Globes.
I thought I would capture the current cultural moment that we're living in and ask you a very specific question. Oppenheimer versus Barbie. Which film will you see first?
It's going to be Barbie.
Oh, me too.
Mm-hmm. One of my very good friends in California, his birthday is tomorrow, and he's having a Barbie-themed party. Mm. So, and in his honor tomorrow, I will be wearing bright pink. I'm not going to be in the same city as them. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's going to be the Barbie movie. We've been talking about it forever.
And yeah.
Awesome.
I didn't realize I was that into it until I saw that, you know.
Yeah.
Until you got excited about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Cool. You learn something about yourself every day, right?
I know, right?
I'm just excited to see Ryan Gosling as a Ken doll. Like,
hello. Oh, my goodness. Yes.
Yeah.
Completely. Yeah. Completely.
All right. Well, now that we have all admitted that we are Barbie fans.
Mm-hmm. And we are heartbroken that the film did not get the recognition it deserved.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Anyway, but let's come back to advocacy.
And listeners, please note that this episode, the way we're talking about advocacy, is specific to the U.S. context, within U.S. structures. Mm-hmm. The kind of advocacy one might do elsewhere would probably look very different.
Right, right. Now let's learn about how Rosemary became involved with advocacy.
So what inspired you to begin your advocacy work within the field of ESL or TESOL in the United States?
I think I've always had my eye on things or always been an advocate, and I would credit that to my elementary school teachers. Aww. Because we always had some sort of thing that we were doing that was social justice and that you would for, you know, third graders, right? Maybe it's, you know, remembering veterans at a VA hospital kind of thing, or just like saying, hey, we got to remember them over there, or working with like collecting food for something, or even as a kid helping some of my classmates with translation in Spanish. And what it really got into it was when I was before my teacher life, I worked in a restaurant and I would always be working with some of the staff. It's like, hey, my son brought this home. Can you help me with this? And I always felt like, because I am bilingual, and I was like, well, why they should have the resources. If I can be just kind of like a conduit to, like, to help along with that, not like I'm going to come in and save the day and teach you this language because you have to learn it. More like, yeah, here are the tools. You take them and be like, hey, this is not right, or this is great. How can we keep moving this forward? It doesn't mean that something's always bad happening, right, when it comes with the learners. But unfortunately, there have been a lot of situations where I'm like, oh my gosh, I cannot believe that you guys are having to deal with this. And a lot of it is a language barrier. I mean, you know, and with language, there is culture too, right? So a lot of folks that work with multilingual people do not understand cultural differences either. Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of that. So I would say my whole entire grown-up life, it's been a thing, because I'm just like, a lot of the world speaks more than one language, and it's an asset for whatever context you're in, and why can't we have more people like that?
Yeah. And I mean, I'm thinking, you know, in our country, you know, we do have listeners from other parts of the world, but in our country, you know, multilingualism is it can be kind of contentious, and, you know, this focus on English, you know, as everyone needs to learn English, why don't you speak English? You know, it's important to have people like you and other advocates in multilingual people's corner, basically.
I appreciate that, you know, you're approaching it from not only like an asset-based perspective, but you're not saying, you know, I'm going to save you. Instead, I've got some tools, and they're really important, and I want to share them with you. I think that sort of framing is really important.
And I know this is sort of becoming, or has been, I don't know, in the last like few years with TESOL, is decolonizing English language teaching, right? It is a global language, and it is something that is helpful for so many people, and it's there, right? But it doesn't mean it's the best one, right? So you have, like you said, it's the tools in your toolbox, and we take them out with us to move around in the world.
Yeah. Awesome. That's.
I've met a lot of bilingual individuals who have taken on the role of translator from an early age, and I think that alone demonstrates how much of an asset multilingualism is.
Yeah, yeah. And within the context of the U.S., it really shows how much better we can do, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it shouldn't be on the kids to translate notes home for their parents. School districts can translate materials going home to families.
Absolutely. It's a fairly easy way to show just a bit more sensitivity to linguistic diversity.
Advocacy! No. It is, but it is. We're advocating right now. But anyway, Rosemary's path to advocacy really resonated with me because it was a similar experience that drove me to teach adults.
Huh, really? How so?
Well, I don't know if I've talked to you much about the tutoring that I did with bilingual kids in Providence Public Schools, Anna. For a few years while I was working on my bachelor's degree, I used to do in-home literacy tutoring for second and third graders. And I would sit at the kitchen table with the student working on reading exercises, and the parents or aunts, grandfathers, whoever was in the house would often gather around and listen. They were so eager to engage in their kids' education and learn on their own, but often, they shared that the school didn't offer opportunities for them to get more involved, that they often didn't understand what was expected of them as stakeholders in their kids' education. And I remember that making me really angry, thinking that it should be easier. And so then I decided to get my master's in TESOL to work with adult learners of English, like those students' family members, and ensure that they could participate how they wanted to.
Love the little origin story there, Shay. And I actually don't know if I knew all of that about you. But that makes me think of what Rosemary said about wanting to share the tools she's acquired with others, expanding access and helping people navigate what can be a confusing and exclusive system.
Let's learn more about what causes Rosemary is advocating for within the U.S. education landscape.
Absolutely. So you've kind of hinted at this a little bit, but can you explain for our audience a little bit what you are advocating for then with these multilingual people, learn whether they're learners or just in everyday life? And what really are those causes within education, but also within, you know, the broader U.S.?
I think within the U.S., there's education and there's also immigration, which also, like, deals with immigrants and refugees, or even people that have been here for generations, how we define multilingual learners and mm-hmm. what the resources that they have access to in the United States. At the federal level, there's a lot of alphabet soup with different programs and the way funding goes, so it can be very overwhelming for people when they first dive in, if that's the route that you want to go with advocacy. So, I mean, mm-hmm. it could be federal funding and programs, which is kind of like the overarching with the picture and umbrella, and then it kind of drops down into the state level and mm-hmm. then into local communities. And that's not the only funding that goes to these programs that helps all the multilingual learners, but it's a big part, right? At least it's the part where I think people who, if they think of education or ESL, that's probably what they're thinking of first.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
But it mostly has to do with a lot of it breaks down to money. And so you're almost like being like a lobbyist going and talking to people.
So what exactly are you talking about when you talk about funding? What kinds of programs are you trying to gather funding for?
So every year, the U.S. has a budget, right? And there's a certain amount of money that's allocated for that. They usually reference the year before to decide, oh, hey, we're going to continue with this, or maybe we'll add some more money to it, or maybe we'll take away some money. This year, they're really looking to take away a lot of money. And we already know education in general already needs more money, not less. And that's just for everything across the board. So it's things that affect K-12 schooling. So that could be students who are in whatever the program is. Every student has to, by law, have the resources. They have to have access to English language learning at some point. It is a law, but not all districts have the resources. So mm-hmm. they kind of work their way through it, how they can manage that happen. So the programs look different in different places. Yeah, so there's that. There is funding for adult ed, like community college programs, mm-hmm. worker training, mm-hmm. even higher ed and teacher training, everything that relates to English language learning mm-hmm. and teaching is affected by these things. And it's not solely just the English learners. I mean, a lot of different programs fall underneath the titles of how the funding goes across. Mm-hmm. The biggest ones I think that people might, if they are familiar with it, is ESSA. It's ESSA, the Every Student Succeeds Act. That's for K-12, primary and secondary. And then WIOA, which is WIOA, and that is the workforce training, and that's for adults. And then there's another part, too, that deals with teacher training under one of the titles. Mm-hmm. So that's everybody. That's all of us mm-hmm. that work within the system in some way or another, whether it's public or private. Mm-hmm.
Something that mm-hmm. struck me in speaking with Rosemary is just how complicated this can be with mm-hmm. the funding being categorized differently at the federal level, at the state level, locally, across age groups and different kinds of education. Mm-hmm. Teachers need to know where funding for programs that are important to them is coming from.
Right. And where funding for a particular program is coming from determines who you should be speaking to about having the funding increased or minimally sustained.
Mm-hmm. If you're outside of the advocacy world, this isn't common knowledge.
No, you're right. Actually, during this conversation, Rosemary mentioned WIOA, which stands for Workforce Innovation and Opportunity Act. And that's a federal program. I remember when a community-based organization I was working with received some sort of funding from this source to help individuals with the job search process and career development. I knew we got additional funding, but I didn't know where it came from.
Yeah, right. We often don't know. Oh. So even if you are operating within this sphere, there's a lot to learn. Mm-hmm. Rosemary shared a bunch of resources that we've linked in the show notes, listeners, if you're mm-hmm. curious about the different tiers of funding available, for what purposes, etc. Mm-hmm.
Rosemary also shared a bit about the importance of having an understanding of how this works and using it as a starting point to craft your messaging for policymakers.
There's so many different ways that you can do it. But if you're speaking about the federal level and you're just like, hey, funding for education in general, mm-hmm. if you know some of these specific things and how it affects your community. And you don't even need to be very deep into what those programs are. You can just tell a story of how something is going on in your community, mm-hmm. really, and say, hey, I've got this family. They're here from Afghanistan. They're all these different levels. So you've got the kids in a school, and then also I've got the parents. The parents should also have access to these tools. And depending on who you're speaking to, sometimes you want to frame it around money and be like, they can contribute to the economy and all of these things. Or you could be like, just think about how great it is to have another culture in our community sharing what they know, and then our community can learn from them. I've learned there's just different talking points depending on who you're going to. But really, if it's just the story about what's happening in your community, I mean, that's kind of like the biggest thing mm-hmm. that can be helpful. And it does not need to be super long or anything like that. It's really in DC. If you're speaking to somebody in person, it's sometimes like maybe 5 minutes that you have mm-hmm. with them, and it's super quick. So you got to be just really fast. Or if you're sharing an email, even you could just very quick little blurb, mm-hmm. and sometimes that's helpful because they do read all that stuff. It doesn't mean it may not happen in a timeline that you mm-hmm. are hoping for, but it's all helpful.
Mm-hmm. It's encouraging to know that what you're observing within your community can serve as a starting point for engaging in meaningful dialogue on the topic. I'm an overthinker, and I think many of us are, and uh-huh. I've definitely found myself in a state of paralysis thinking, what can I say? Where do I begin? Start with where you are.
Yeah, I mean, it can feel overwhelming, but what you're witnessing firsthand in your community, the positives of new funding or the challenges of not enough funding, that can be a catalyst for change, for taking action. Mm-hmm. Maybe you're meeting with local legislators, or maybe like Rosemary, you throw yourself into the work and attend mm-hmm. advocacy summits, coming together with like-minded individuals. Mm-hmm. So let's hear about her time at the TESOL Advocacy Summit in Washington, D.C. last year.
Tell us more about your time in D.C. Who did you meet with? What did you accomplish? Yeah, challenges, successes,
reflections.
So the summit, it's over 2 days. And it's affiliates, well, everybody across this United States, you know, is invited to come. So this year there were, I want to say, 29 affiliates represented across the states. And so you have 1 day of, like, workshops. There's kind of a review of the major laws or court cases that affect education, like Brown versus Board of Education, and kind of, you know, the big things that maybe we might remember from history class. Mm-hmm. And then some things that you might not have known before. And then there's new speakers that come and just kind of talk about what's going on, what's current. And then there's always a group of staffers that come from a couple of different representatives' offices to kind of like ease everybody's nerves a little bit, is just saying, okay, this is what you should do when you come in. Tell us your name, who you're with. Give us your story, say thank you, and we'll keep in touch. Mm-hmm. Basically, is this kind of like the 4 points of things, and you can easily do that in a few minutes. And then there's a day on the Hill. So before you go to D.C., so Advocacy Day is usually one day. It's usually the Wednesday of the summit, and each affiliate organize meetings with your representatives and your senators. And so that's at least one representative, depending on your district, and the two senators. Mm-hmm. Goal for WASOL was to have us touch all 10 districts in Washington State. Mm-hmm. And that can be challenging because some offices are like, you don't live in our district, so you cannot talk to us. But as WASOL, we represent the whole state, mm-hmm. right? So, and I just wanted to make sure that we touched everyone. And so we had 7 meetings, one in a hallway that was impromptu, going by dropping off a leave behind. And then we were able to leave information back with all 10 districts, which was really cool. And we had some really great conversations. We met one congresswoman, Representative Schreier. She's from District 8. Who was very gracious to spend like some time with us, and then it was with their staffer, but it was really cool. We met with all staffers, which is not disappointing. Some people at first you're like, I want to meet the big person, you know, the senator or the representative. But the staffers are the ones that do the research. They get all the information together. They have their portfolios that they work on, and they give the information to the representative or the senator. So they're who you want to get in with. I think overall that was successful. It was a lot of walking back and forth.
Yeah.
In scheduling, I did not keep in mind House side versus Senate side, and like walking from one side of the Capitol to the other. And we had to do that a couple of times. Got my steps in for
That's
sure.
That's good to know for logistics for any listeners thinking of going to the summit. Just know.
Yeah.
House and Senate.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And the time, because sometimes you don't realize how long it's going to take you to get from one side to the other because you got to go through security and all of that. Overall, I think it was pretty successful in sending thank yous after the fact. I mean, we heard back from just about everybody. Yeah, I don't follow up again. And connecting people. So if there's people in districts I tried to that I know of because I don't live there, I was able to connect them. So hopefully we're keeping these conversations going.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. So
sounds great. Like a productive 2 days for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it was good. I think the biggest challenge, though, is keeping up and keeping the momentum going, right? It's all, you're so excited, you're there, mm-hmm. and you're doing all the things, and you're connecting with these amazing educators from across the country. Mm-hmm. It's definitely more intimate, like way more intimate than the big, big convention, mm-hmm. and you're all there focused on the advocacy component of being an educator. But it's really cool. I think the biggest challenge is remembering to just like take a moment and breathe and relax, stop and look around and see where you're at. And then remembering not to be discouraged if you don't hear back from an office right away. Cause sometimes it's like the morning of, or like, oh yeah, sure. Pop right on in. And I'm like, how am I going to make this happen? But it works.
Yeah.
Like just being in DC is just really cool. And then also it kind of takes off that like that Wizard of Oz, like the man behind the curtain, and you go in and you talk to, and these are real people. And then some of the staffers, they were English learners and multilingual learners, some of them, which is great. So then they really connect. So you've got a little in your pocket. You're like, all right, I'm gonna talk to you, be like, hey, can you pass this on to your representative, or can you pass this on to the senator?
I love that Rosemary highlights the importance of connection here. Just talking to people, whether it's with a staffer at Capitol Hill or those in your advocacy community.
Mm-hmm. And whether you connect with who you're speaking with in terms of ideology or how funding should or should not be allocated, a little kindness and a lot of patience goes a long way.
Here, like, and I know people get very annoyed with politics and I don't think you even need to go in with a mindset like that. You just be like, hey, we need some money. We got some kids we need to teach. Mm-hmm. We have some parents that need to learn. We need teachers. Mm-hmm. So it all benefits, you know, the country as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. I mean,
yeah. It sounds like patience is a virtue.
It totally is. And then we all get annoyed with it. It's just like, ugh, I want to shut the TV off, or whatever, not pay attention to the Twitter feed. But it is important. Like, it's stories. Share a story. You don't have to say, well, I agree with, or I hate, da-da-da-da-da. Like, and even the thank yous for support are huge, because the staffers even said, like, we get so many calls of people that are like, bah, 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 bah. Like, you know, very angry, just saying, I don't like this, or you're terrible, blah, 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 blah. Mm-hmm. And he said, when we hear thank yous, because those aren't many all the time, they love it. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So even if it's not a phone call, it could be an email.
Yeah. So many lessons packed in here, I think.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, just like, first of all, kindness goes further than just an angry rant will. Mm-hmm. And then secondly, you know, I think you kind of alluded to this earlier, but really advocacy seems like we need to think about it as a long game rather than I need this to happen now. Mm-hmm. It's planting the seed, fostering these mm-hmm. relationships, having these conversations, these aren't mm-hmm. ideas that are going to disappear from their minds after they've seen mm-hmm. you, especially if they had a positive interaction. It's something that maybe next year they could address or, you know, even longer mm-hmm. term. I mean, I know that everyone needs the money now, but, mm-hmm. you know, it's building blocks. So, yeah.
100%. Mm-hmm. That's actually a very good way to look at it. And with our, you know, TikTok and YouTube minds, mm-hmm. the attention spans, right? Sometimes we forget how long things actually mm-hmm. take, and especially when it comes to government.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's slow moving for a reason, frustratingly so, mm-hmm. but it is slow moving for a reason mm-hmm. because mm-hmm. you want to avoid big missteps, or, you know, you're trying to calculate mm-hmm. where everything goes. So yeah, that this really helped me, you know, what you were saying really helped me sort of understand that better. Mm-hmm. And not even just if you're mm-hmm. working on more directly government related advocacy, mm-hmm. but just advocacy in general as a person mm-hmm. advocating for people. It's not just a like one and done thing. Mm-hmm. It's ongoing. Mm-hmm. It's ongoing. Mm-hmm. So I really appreciate.
So even though having a long-term mindset can be challenging, as Rosemary highlighted, we do live in the era of instant gratification, right? Mm-hmm. Having a long-term mindset can be really useful for individuals engaging in advocacy at any level.
Yeah, and this is especially true for classroom teachers who are on the ground, already experiencing everyday stress and fatigue. Mm-hmm. Knowing that advocacy efforts can and should be ongoing and not expecting things to change overnight can at least help alleviate some of the pressure we put on ourselves.
For sure. Let's hear about some other ways that teachers can be advocates without traveling to DC. That everyday advocacy.
And I know, like, as teachers, I think one thing that can be intimidating about if you're advocating really at any level, wherever it's just like, okay, interacting with your peers around you, your colleagues, or just checking in with people and, you know, like, hey, I saw this today, it came through, take a look when you have some time. Or, you know, like I said, talking with your students, which teachers do anyway. There's fatigue, right? Mm-hmm. You've got lessons to plan, meetings, and all of these things, and then professional development, all of this stuff happening, and they're like, okay, and you want me to do this? Mm-hmm. It can be overwhelming. So I think my whole thing about advocacy is like, it doesn't need to be this crazy lift. Mm-hmm. Like Anna said, you had like the levels of it. Like somebody explained it to me once. It was at the very first TESOL Policy and Advocacy Summit that I went to, and they said there's like a low lift, a medium lift, and a heavy lift. And a heavy lift would be going and talking to your representatives, whatever level of government. Low lift, like I said, is just that interaction, and you start like where you're at in your circle, like you're already having these conversations, and yes, that is, you're advocating for your people, mm-hmm. right? And then there's in between, which could be, you know, a little bit of both. Mm-hmm. So trying to think of it like that definitely helps with the fatigue that, I mean, everybody feels, right? Yeah.
Sounds like you're doing the heavy lift though, huh, Rosemary?
Yeah, I am, but you know what? I enjoy it.
You've created this entry point, I think, for listeners, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. including myself, mm-hmm. you know, this idea of thinking mm-hmm. of advocacy in tiers, the little lift, the light lift, so, you know, the medium and heavy, because mm-hmm. I think that a lot of people assume mm-hmm. that they have to dedicate their lives to being an advocate, mm-hmm. you know, and they don't necessarily recognize the ways in which they're already doing that in mm-hmm. their own unique setting. So I think that there are going to be a lot of people inspired by this conversation, Rosemary. So,
I hope so.
For that. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That was going to be the one thing that I was going to say, is just as far as like advice goes, or just start where you are. And mm-hmm. if that's where you want to be, then like live there and work there. Because a lot of, I mean, any movement that we've studied or been a part of in our lifetime or lifetimes before us that have happened, it did not start with somebody, you know, organizing a march on Washington, right away. It's all these little things. And there weren't people that were able to go, you know, do those things. So it was, you know, it's start where you are, see where you're comfortable. If you want to grow beyond those boundaries and kind of step outside that and end up in Washington, D.C. or in your local district's office, mm-hmm. absolutely do that. But it by no means does it mean to, you gotta, you know, do more than what you feel that you're capable of, or exhaust yourself. Yeah.
Are there some resources that you'd like to share that you would recommend someone just starting out take a look at to sort of orient themselves? Mm-hmm.
The TESOL website's a lot easier to navigate now since they redid it right before the big convention. And their advocacy tab there, it has a lot of great resources there. There's tons of information there that you can start from that's kind of digestible. Another place to look for wanting to know about what's going on specifically with like the Department of Ed and how funding is happening is the Office of English Language Acquisition, which is underneath U.S. Department of Education. I had no idea that that existed until I went to the summit. But when you look at the demographics of the U.S. and how it's changing, slowly growing into majority-minority country, and there's a lot of people from a lot of different places, a lot of different heritages, and I know the Secretary of Education is trying to promote multilingualism and like that every teacher is a teacher of multilinguals.
Every teacher is a teacher of multilingual students. Brilliant.
Mm-hmm. And every teacher is an advocate. So, mm-hmm. Teachers, we want to hear from you. Have you engaged in advocacy efforts as a language teacher? What did that look like?
You can share with us in a comment on social media or email us at teacherthinkaloud@gmail.com. We welcome your questions, reflections, and ideas.
And don't forget to like this episode, comment, and or subscribe. We want you to be a part of our community of practice. As always, friends, thanks for joining us on the Teacher Think Aloud podcast. And until next time, happy teaching.
And happy reflecting.